space or beyond. I can't remember exactly, but the netting was significantly more developed than when the last time I'd been to a game. But I'll look for it specifically when I go to Target Field this weekend, and I'll let you know.
Yeah, I'll be curious.
Yeah, I suspect that that's where these guys are all going to go moving forward.
All right, the matter before the court at this time is the August rules hearing. There were seven proposed amendments that were noticed by the court for today at 11 o'clock. I will go through each of these individually in order that I have them in the as submitted. And the first one that's before the court is a proposal to amend various sections to authorize the expanded use of interactive audiovisual devices. And I know we have Judge Feifley as a proponent who's appearing by video, but let me just inquire here in the courtroom, is there anybody that's in opposition to the rule here today that's appearing? No opponents. So then, Judge Feifley, I understand you wanted to do a short demonstration of the use of the audiovisual devices in your courtroom out in Pennington County, and then you can make any additional comments with respect to the rule once you've done that. So go ahead and proceed. We've got you up on the screen, and we can see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm wondering if you have anyone there that could switch the camera view on your end from the lectern to the court itself, so I feel like I'm addressing the court rather than looking at an empty lectern. I didn't realize the court had actually come into session. My apologies. Captain Munch and I from the Pennington County Sheriff's Office have a common interest in baseball, and we were discussing the lack of ability of the 2021 Minnesota Twins before the court came in.
There you go. You've got a couple of justices now.
Thank you. I thought it appropriate as we had this discussion, Chief and justices, to give you some idea of what it might look like on a regular basis when we have an audio-visual connection with one of the facilities that we regularly have been having court with over the course of the pandemic. I think it's first important to note that absent this ability to do this over the last 18 months, we would have been in a position where we would have had the ability to have court severely compromised. And so I think we've learned some things during the use of audiovisual technology that has come about as a result of the court's emergency order that I think makes some sense for us to consider long term. And so one of the things that I had asked of the Chief Justice was an opportunity to appear electronically, both of which helped accommodate my schedule. I have a two-day divorce trial that was scheduled for this week that allowed me the opportunity to do that, this appearance in this fashion as a result of that particular schedule constriction. And also I think was important to allow the court some opportunity to see how audio-visual connections work in real time on a trial court's calendar. I have with me Captain Casey Munch, who's with the Pennington County Sheriff's Office, who is appearing in one of the video courtrooms that we connect with regularly on the Pennington County Jail. And I've asked Captain Munch to appear for a couple of purposes, one of which is to give the court an opportunity to see exactly what the interface would look like when a trial court judge is addressing someone who is in custody and is appearing on an audiovisual feed. You can see exactly the feed that the court sees on a regular basis. You can get an opportunity to tell how we can interact in these circumstances. And it also, I think, gives an opportunity, if you had any questions from the court standpoint, that Captain Munch could address in terms of responding to questions, so you can not only see what the court sees on a regular basis in these audiovisual feeds, but can also hear that interaction. Captain Munch, can you say hello and greet the court here this morning?
Hello. It's a pleasure to meet you.
So that's the audio part that you'll hear on a regular basis that we hear. The view that you're seeing here in my courtroom is the view that I would use if I'm addressing an individual in custody that we're arraigning, for example, on a new felony charge. This gives that individual the opportunity for me to not only see the individual and answer those questions, but also gives that individual an opportunity to see me. What you're seeing from my courtroom is what Captain Munch is seeing in the Pennington County facility. We use this not only with our local jails to connect with, but we also use it with remote facilities, including regularly having connections of this type with Department of Correction facilities to allow us to sort of speed those matters along. If you don't mind, Chief, excuse me, what I'd like to do next is give you some opportunity to see the various views that we can use when we're having an audiovisual court proceeding. This first view is limited to the bench. That gives me the opportunity to have an individual who is participating in this fashion see me get an understanding of what I'm trying to convey. I also have a couple of other views that we regularly use in these types of proceedings. If, for example, I need to include an opportunity for someone to see an individual from a witness stand, this is the view that we would use for that. If I have counsel here, and we would use this, for example, pretty regularly when I have someone that's in a DOC facility but are addressing their case, but counsel is from Rapid City, I can give a view to allow counsel table to be shown, but that then allows the individual who is participating through the audiovisual feed to see and hear their attorney. And then finally, if we have the need, we can do so in a manner which includes the entire well of the courtroom. So you can see that the audiovisual connection allows us some fairly significant capabilities in terms of how we can present court and use it relatively quickly in terms of what's happening. The reason that I am asking the court to consider continuing allowing trial court judges to use an audiovisual connect moving forward once the court's emergency order is lifted is that, again, we have found during the course of this pandemic that the access to the court has been increased in those circumstances in which we have this particular capability. Right now, we have the discretion in order to have this happen. We'd like to have that discretion continue. And let me give you a couple of concrete examples. Regularly, we have appearances by individuals who are in Department of Corrections custody. With personal transport to the Pennington County Jail and then appearance in court, that then takes that individual out of the DOC control for a period that can last as long as 1 week. We dramatically impact those individuals in terms of their programming at the DOC facility. Perhaps they're on a work release or they're in a minimum custody unit. That impacts that sort of return to community status. But by having this ability to do this in this fashion, two things happen. One of which is it allows us to have a significantly increased access to court. And that's not limited to the DOC folks, but that allows us to have a much quicker access to court proceedings if we can connect via audiovisual means versus having to worry about certain transport times and folks being brought over who are in custody. The second thing that it does, as I mentioned, is that it helps lessen the impact of the individual who is appearing in court. And so we believe that access to the court system is significantly increased by use of these additional means to allow court proceedings to occur. When this was last proposed by the presiding judge's counsel, there was an objection to the proceedings asking for there to be a defendant's choice option as it related to issues surrounding sentencing. We've addressed those issues in terms of the newly proposed rule change. And I think for the reasons that have been expressed, as you can see, we believe that this increases access to the courts. It allows us to more efficiently respond to changes in circumstance for individuals, results in no significant or any, actually, reduction of rights in the kinds of hearings that we're asking to be held in this fashion. And so for these reasons, would ask the court to give due consideration to the proposed rule changes. With that, I remain available for any questions. And I know if you'd like to hear from Captain Munch in terms of sort of how this works from his perspective, I'm sure he'd be happy to answer questions as well. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Are there any questions from the members of the court for Judge Feifley or Captain?
I have a couple. Hello, Judge Feifley. Thank you for arranging for this demonstration. With reference to the jail link, are you doing then group arraignments? You know, the sheriff presents as an individual. Are you doing group arraignments, and if so, at what number?
Generally, Justice Kern, we will do group arraignments. Those numbers, we try to keep to four or fewer individuals. We have multiple groups that happen during the course of the day. This is sort of, frankly, an outlier. We asked that some schedules be cleared so we could keep this room open for your use with Captain Munch. But our protocol is to use these rooms all day, most days, for these types of hearings, but we do it intentionally to keep our numbers down.
And so would counsel then appear with their client at arraignment in the same room?
Yes.
So each attorney then would be available to sit next to their client during the arraignment?
Yes. And I will say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt the question. I will say, just so there's no confusion, we on occasion will have attorneys that will remain on the video end, on this end, and appear, and we allow that to happen with the client's consent.
And so for sentencing proceedings, are those individualized in that, or are they done in group fashion in a large room with the attorneys present at the jail or in the courtroom? How is that handled?
Again, the protocol would be similar, Justice Kern. We'd have a limited number of folks in the jail audiovisual courtroom area. Attorneys are regularly present with the individual. The cases are called forward to the table where you see Captain Munch, and then the issues addressed, including sentencing hearings as well.
And so the family members or interested citizens involved are then in another room in the courthouse at this point?
They are not. They are in the courtroom itself. They will have two different screens that are available to view the jail proceedings on, where they would see exactly what you're seeing here today. I have a 60-inch television monitor that directly addresses the gallery. And then I also have a large video screen that I drop so they can view it on two different screens. Each courtroom would have that video monitor access.
So is the Pennington County Jail, under the emergency order, transporting any defendants? Is it to the courthouse for court in person at this point?
We have a hybrid situation going on here. We obviously transport for all those circumstances in which we have confrontation issues or for which witnesses may be present, longer sentencing hearings and the like.
Are defendants given the opportunity to request personal appearance at every phase of their case?
They are.
Those are all my questions. Thank you.
Are there other questions from the members of the court?
I have one. Judge Feifley, the modification that was made after the prior rules hearing, to referencing felony sentencing hearings involving a Class 4 felony or higher, the defendant retains the right to appear in person. Can you explain a little bit more of the thinking as to how you drew that line? And, you know what, it occurred to me it may have to do with the presumptive probation offenses, but, you know, they also may result in incarceration, or there may be some Class 5s and 6s that are excluded from presumptive probation. But could you explain more of the thought process behind how you came up with the proposal at Class 4 felonies?
Sure. That was a discussion, Justice Devaney, that arose out of the presiding judge's counsel. One of the objections, I think the only objection or note in opposition that came before the court at the last time the presiding judge's counsel approached the court with this request was from the director of the Pennington County Public Defender's Office. This particular modification came as a result of my discussions with him, Mr. Eric Witcher. The expectation was is that in these circumstances where we had Class 4s or above, the defense on occasion has more information that they wish to present to the court, and as a result, that was where the line was drawn. Again, as mentioned with Justice Kern, we regularly will accommodate defense requests if there is some specific reason for in-court determination of issues, including all phases of the defense proceedings. This was simply a clarification to make sure that this was taken outside of judicial discretion if you had a more serious felony for which there was some significant time being faced in the DOC facility, that the defendant retained the right versus a discretionary decision by the judge.
Are there other questions from any of the justices? Not hearing any. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak on Proposal 1? All right. Well, Judge Feifley, thank you again for your time and willingness to present this morning. I'm going to see if I can sign you off. You're certainly welcome to stay, but I assume you're ready to go.
I will. I'm happy to participate and remain chief, but I'm sure that Captain Munch has other things that will require his time. So I think from our perspective, we'll sign off.
All right.
Thank you very much.
We'll let you go. Thank you. The second proposed amendment, rules amendment for this morning, relates to Section 4.5 of the State of South Dakota bylaw, State Bar of South Dakota bylaws, relating to membership fees. Is there anyone that...
You are the only participant in the conference.
Is there anyone here today that wishes to speak in opposition to proposal number 2? Not seeing any opponents. Are there any proponents? Mr. Fergal?
The host has left the conference. The conference is about to end.
You are the only participant in the conference.
Chief Justice Jensen and members of the court, thank you for your time here today. I just have a few things to say about the proposal. Obviously, I am here in support of the proposal to amend Section 4.5 of the State Bar bylaws to increase bar dues and CLE fees. I would tell you the last time the State Bar was before the court asking you to approve a dues or fee increase was in August of 2007, on August 29th, 2007. So we are coming up on 14 years since the bar last requested a bar dues and CLE fee increase. The proposal before you today would increase active dues by $100 and CLE fees by $25. and inactive member dues by $25. So under the proposal, dues and fees for members admitted for 5 years or more would be $540 per year and $415 per year for those in their second through fourth year after admission. Dues will continue to be waived in the first year of admission in South Dakota unless the person has been admitted in another jurisdiction in any prior year to admission in South Dakota. Again, the last time dues were increased was in 2008. Again, we have done what I would call significant increases in that it our increase is $100 or more. And the reason for that is to extend the time for which the
you are the only the participant in the conference.
In place. So we usually start to create some reserves. We get up to a point where our expenses match our income, and then we spend down. And so we're very much down in the valley now since that last dues increase. The only other thing I would say is that this was approved by the membership at our annual meeting on June 18th this past year with very little opposition. Therefore, I would ask you to approve the amendment to Section 4.5 of the state bylaws as requested. And I would also note that if you do approve it, that the change to the bylaw be effective January 1, 2022. And I'll stand by for questions if you have any.
Are there any questions from the members of the court concerning the proposal? Is there anyone else that wishes to speak with respect to the proposed rule? No one spoken up. So we'll move on to proposed rule number three, which is the proposed adoption of the preamble and scope of the rules for professional conduct found in the appendix to SDCL Chapter 16-18. Is there anyone that wishes to speak in opposition to that proposal? Not seeing any. Is there anyone that wishes to speak in support of the proposal? Mr. Satizan.
Good morning. May it please the court. Greg Satizan, State Court Administrator for the Unified Judicial System. This proposal originates with some of the work that was done by the Supreme Court's Commission on
You are the only participant in the conference.
In the legal profession. And as a result of that work and the rule proposals that were being discussed, it became apparent that when we speak to the model rules of professional conduct and the rules of professional conduct for lawyers, the court has adopted the rules themselves, but the preamble, the scope, and the comments have never been adopted by the court. And so as we discuss that, the commentary is clearly meant to be just that, to provide explanation and guidance to practitioners.
Your call will be
disconnected. For the rules. But the preamble and the scope are a little bit different. The preamble, and if you read it, it's very clear. It sets the expectations for members of the bar in many respects, how they interact with other lawyers, how they engage themselves personally and professionally. And I certainly feel that that's a statement that best comes from our Supreme Court that regulates the profession. Likewise, the scope, really, and the way the commentary, the language and the scope describes it in Section 21 is that the scope represents the general orientation to the rules. It really provides that background on what the rules are and what the rules are not. And so as a result of that, I feel that in our proposal is that by the court adopting the scope and the preamble, it creates that framework for the rules of professional conduct that would still allow the way the current process works is the State Bar Ethics Committee makes adaptations to the commentary that reflect changes to the rules or things that could be added by way of explanation or guidance to practitioners. And so that would continue, but the preamble and the scope would be treated as formal court rules and a pronouncement from this court. I would think that would be appropriate, and so that is the reason for the rule proposal. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the members of the court? Not hearing any. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak as to proposal number three? no one else has spoken up, so we'll proceed on to proposal number four. This is proposed amendment to the appendix to SDCL Chapter 16-18 relating to the Rules of Professional Conduct Rule 1.2 and the scope of representation. Is there anyone that wishes to speak in opposition to proposal number four? No one in opposition. Is there anyone that wishes to speak in support of proposal number four? Mr. Moorhead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. My name is Sandra Moorhead. I'm an attorney with Woods, Fuller, Schultz, and Smith in Sioux Falls, but here today as the chair of the South Dakota State Bar Ethics Committee. Some brief background on the proposal. After the Ethics Committee issued two opinions related to legal services for the marijuana industry, the Board of Bar Commissioners asked the committee to propose revisions to Rule 1.2D of the Rules of Professional Conduct to address the conflict between South Dakota state law and federal law with regard to the cultivation, use, distribution of cannabis. The committee understood the request was to provide proposals to address that conflict, and the committee did so. The committee surveyed initially how all of the other states that have addressed this issue have done so. A few states have relied solely on either an ethics opinion affirmatively sanctioning providing legal services to marijuana distributors or policy statements from disciplinary boards that such conduct would not be subject to discipline. The committee agreed the better and more common approach nationwide was to either modify the rules to specifically address the issue or to add a comment to the rules for the same purpose. Within that overall rubric, there have been two general approaches that have been taken. One has been to make a very small modification to the rule with a much longer explanatory comment. The other is just to have a long rule that essentially pulls within it an exemplary set, but not exhaustive set of conduct and advice that would be permitted. The Ethics Committee was fairly evenly split about which of those two approaches initially would be appropriate. The concern being that the shorter rule would leave a number of questions. The concern that a longer explanatory rule would, by maybe omission of something, leave practitioners in doubt that by not affirmatively sanctioning something, it wouldn't be permitted. So the decision was made to follow a third hybrid approach, exemplified by the state of New Jersey, incidentally, which added a short change to the rules, but then a much longer explanatory comment that made it clear that the rule was intended only to be exemplary and that it would not necessarily foreclose conduct and advice outside the scope of what was permitted. And that was pretty much unanimously agreed by the committee to be the best approach. However, all of those approaches were submitted to the state bar commissioners, and after consideration, they determined that that final approach, which is the proposal that's before you, would be the best approach. A new 1.2E that would clarify that providing advice on this subject matter would be permitted notwithstanding the conflict between state and federal law, and a longer explanatory comment. One last thing that was considered along the way was whether or not it would be appropriate to actually have a change to the rule, a new section of the rule that would clarify that in any case where there's a conflict between state and federal law, that advising clients would be permitted to the extent that the conduct at issue would be permitted under state law. The committee and the commissioners, I believe, agreed that it was appropriate instead to address this on a point-by-point basis, particularly apt given the, I think, rise in sometimes differences between states and federal government about how best to approach things. And so the proposal before you here is a proponent, notwithstanding the possibility that recreational marijuana That decision remains. The medical marijuana bill is not affected by that. There are various people who will be seeking advice from practitioners, also localities that will want to be receiving advice from their council on how best to address the medical marijuana statutes and all the regulations that will have to be drafted and dealt with. And so I stand here still as a proponent today. It was, with I believe one voice, nay, at the state bar, approved by the membership. I'd propose that it be effective immediately because this is an issue that continues to be something that the Ethics Committee gets questions about. And that is the end of my presentation, unless there are any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the members of the court?
I have just a couple. First, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the Ethics Committee for the work that you've done in grappling with this challenging issue. How many years have you now been, or months, been working on this question?
The initial inquiry, I believe, there were rumblings that some inquiries might be coming in October or November of last year, and actually at that point, then President Westergaard had the forethought to realize it was coming and actually pulled together some folks to start looking at it. We actually started looking at law review articles and things then, but we decided that the approach, it was not the traditional practice of the Ethics Committee to issue advisory opinions without an inquiry. An inquiry was finally made in December, and that was probably when we started looking at it seriously. Because the commissioners recognized it was going to be an issue. And so I'd say starting in about January, we did that, and the committee was a lot of help. There were two or three members of the committee who volunteered to go out and pull all of the different ways in which states have addressed this issue. And then we had very good, frank conversations about how best to address it. So I'm very happy with how the committee is. I'm proud of the committee that I get to chair. It makes my job very easy, made all the more easier because Law School Dean Fulton laid great groundwork there, and it's been a joy and a privilege to take over for him. So I appreciate the thoughts. And
so I'm fascinated by the research that you've done about what's happening around the country. Have most of the, in the states where marijuana is legalized, have the bars, the ethics committees proceeded, do they all have rule modifications similar to this? Are there some that don't? Are there some that take a contrary approach?
It's been a very interesting mixture of approaches. I would say that there are a few states, and our sense was it was in states where the ethics committees have a broader purview. Where they are more than just advisory committees that are helping essentially provide a service to members of the bar, but are actually instead empowered in their mission statements and by their bars to actually make statements that are more binding. For example, the state of New York and its ethics committee came right out of the gate and said, we think New York, incidentally, a state where the preamble was then part of the rules, said, well, when we read the preamble in relation to this, the preamble says these are all supposed to be rules of reason. And at that time, this was during the President Obama's administration, at that time, that president's Department of Justice had issued binding public policy statements that, notwithstanding the federal criminal statutes, that wasn't going to be a priority for prosecution. And so the New York State Bar, a couple of folks also writing non-binding opinions from the American Bar Association said, well, we think we can read these things together to mean it's a rule of reason. It's not something that's being prosecuted. We think it's okay for practitioners to do this. Not surprisingly, here in South Dakota, where we're a more of an advisory board and where the text is very much emphatically cleaved to here, that wasn't something our committee was comfortable with doing. Incidentally, even states like New York that have done that have gone on to modify their rules, I think, acknowledging that the plain text probably doesn't get them all the way there. There's a few exceptions. Minnesota essentially dealt with it right out of the gate. Their state bar disciplinary board essentially issued a statement saying, we're not going to prosecute, that's probably not the right word, but we're not going to discipline folks for this. And that sort of took care of it. There's been a wide variety of approaches, but I would say even those states that have had some sort of ethics body come out and say that it's permissible have nonetheless gone on to amend their rule so that there's no misunderstanding at all.
Thank you for that history. It's helpful.
Okay.
I have a question, Mr. Moorhead. Just so I want to make sure I understand one of the statements in the comment.
Yes.
I don't know that I have an issue with it, but I'm just not sure exactly what it's referring to. It's the last sentence of the second paragraph that says, finally, the rules of the Federal District Court for the District of South Dakota are not impacted by this comment, even if it has adopted these rules as its own. I'm not quite sure what that is saying. Can you explain that?
So the local rules of the District Court for the District of South Dakota, the District Court has not set forth a separate set of rules of professional conduct. It is said that the rules of professional conduct, as stated by the state of South Dakota, are the rules of court. The reason we included that statement was because as a state bar committee, and our view that it is probably a federalism issue, we were skeptical that, with all due respect, this court could take it upon itself to decide what is and isn't permissible conduct in federal district court. I do think that the occasions on which it's going to matter are extremely rare. Everybody who's a member of the bar here can become a member of the district court bar if they meet the other requirements. I'm trying to envision a situation where it's going to be a concern. Haven't been able to come up with one, but we didn't want to take it upon ourselves to say otherwise. And other states that have gone this route have tended to make that point because of that federalism issue.
Thank you. That clarifies it for me.
There being no other questions from the court, is there anyone else that wishes to speak on rule proposal number 4? All right. Thank you, Mr. Moorhead.
Thank you, Justices.
We'll take up proposals 5 and 6 together. Those both involve proposed amendments to evidentiary rules. The first one, number 5, relates to SDCL 19-19-404B concerning other act evidence. And proposal number 6 relates to SDCL 19-19807 regarding the residual hearsay exception. Is there anyone that wishes to speak in opposition to proposed rules 5 or 6? Not seeing any opponents. Is there anyone that wishes to speak in support of those proposals? Mr. Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, esteemed members of the court. It's an honor to be here before you. I am Matt Murphy. I practice in Sioux Falls at Boyce Law Firm. Today I'm before you as the chair of the Evidence Committee for the State Bar Association. I'm here as the Evidence Committee and on behalf of the bar, as the bar passed both of these proposals unanimously. There was no opposition offered at the bar convention. I'll address SDCL 19-19-404B first. And I think it helps to have a little background on what our committee within the state bar does. The evidence committee since 2016, if you remember at that point, the state kind of overhauled the rules of evidence to more closely mimic the federal rules of evidence. Since that was done, each year our committee has monitored all of the opinions that have come down from the South Dakota Supreme Court to see if any of those rules have created any issues or unforeseen issues, basically. Beyond that, we monitor changes to the federal rules as they're coming down. That's where 404B and 807 came from. The federally, Rule 807 was changed 2 years ago, and then 404B was changed last year. So the committee this year decided we would review both of those rules to come to a determination on whether we should recommend updating South Dakota's rules to match what those rules stated. So addressing 404B first, I won't get into the nuance of every single change that's suggested within that rule. I'll just highlight a couple. The first kind of noteworthy change is that under 404B subpart 2, there's a removal of the requirement that a defendant in a criminal case ask the prosecutor for 404B other act evidence. I came to find, I don't do much criminal work myself, but members of my committee do, I came to find that there was basically a form letter that every criminal defense lawyer would send right out of the gate saying, I want the 404B evidence. So it turned into a letter that was always sent and then a response that was always given, and it was kind of an unnecessary step, is at least what the federal judiciary determined. And it was something that was always happening anyway, so it kind of took that out and just affirmatively places that obligation on the prosecutor to turn over that evidence. And the next kind of highlight I would make for you under 404B3B, this kind of places a little bit of a higher burden on the prosecutor to articulate in the notice the permitted purpose for which the prosecutor intends to offer the evidence and the reasoning that supports the purpose. In other words, the prosecutor has to be more specific on why the evidence in his or her mind meets the 404B exceptions. I think this, well, it was put into place to, again, kind of further make things move a little more economically and efficiently. There's less trial by surprise when you're doing it this way, and it kind of furthers the truth-finding process by avoiding any of the unclarity that was in the prior subpart A and making it very clear on what the prosecutor must do when they intend to use other acts evidence. And then the last part, I guess I would note for you, is there's more clarity on the type of notice that's given and how it should be given. So before I move on to 807, I think it's probably wise to ask if there's any questions on 404B specifically, and I can address those before we move to 807.
Mr. Murphy, when you were working with, by the way, thank you for your work on the committee and your careful study of these evidentiary rules, and I understand that's methodical work, maybe tedious work. You're reviewing what the federal courts and the advisory committee and the rules committee are doing. You're looking at our decisions. And I wondered, in doing that, did you find, and I can see that what you're telling us is absolutely the case, there's a change, I don't know that it's a substantive change, but there's a change in any event to the level of detail that the rule purports to require for prosecutors. Any discernible impact that your committee saw with the existing body of case law in our decisional law?
Sure. When we did the more specific case review of this particular rule, we were split into subparts. I was more on the 807 case review, but Jeff Larson and Lindsay Kwasny headed up the group within our committee that does a lot of criminal law, and they dug through some of the cases, and the report back was that this would have no substantive impact in their minds on existing case law within the state.
Yeah, and it's not a binding thing. Right. I was just curious that I thought maybe you may have looked at that.
And I'll advise the only real hiccup we had with 404B, and we decided to table that part of the discussion, was the prosecutors in our group wanted the rule to be mutual. In other words, if the defendant was somehow going to use 404B evidence, they also wanted that obligation upon the defendant to come forth with it. That we didn't find any state that had done it that way. So we're going to dig into that further and decide in the future if we're going to make that recommendation. But we all agreed unanimously within our committee and at the state bar that this rule made sense to match our rule up with what the federal judiciary is doing.
The federal rule, in fact, and we'll leave that for another time, but the federal rule doesn't include a reciprocal obligation for the defense to give notice.
The federal rule does?
Does not.
Right. No. Correct.
But that's for another day.
I was going to say, if it does, there must be a new one.
It was a statement with a question mark.
Sure. Understood. Any other questions? Okay, I'll jump quickly to 807. 807, although rarely used, it seems like, there is quite a bit of South Dakota Supreme Court case law on it. So that was one of the heavy lifting tasks I had because I was kind of leading the charge on what to do with 807. I can tell you affirmatively before anyone asks, I don't believe that the changes recommended here will have any impact on case law that exists currently. The purpose at the federal level when they made this change was they had a bunch of the courts getting hung up on the statement under 807A subpart 1, which previously read the statement has equivalent circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. And courts were having trouble interpreting that because they were trying to frame an 807 argument within the context of other hearsay exceptions. And the court said, well, if there's other hearsay exceptions, you don't need 807. So that's why that language was stricken. And then the court or then the drafters of this rule changed that to put the statement is supported by sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness after considering the totality of the circumstances under which it was made and evidence, if any, corroborating the statement. So the federal courts and the South Dakota Supreme Court has traditionally used a multifactorial test to weigh whether or not 807 evidence is going to be admitted. The sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness currently are written in the new version of the rule kind of matches up exactly with that. And I think this rule also is an important one to maintain commonality with the federal rule because a lot of our case law cites federal cases on this rule. And so if the new rule causes some sort of a split or shift, it'll be easier to track if our rule matches with what the federal rule says. And then two other quick points I would make. There are some language in the rule that was superfluous that I think was removed to kind of clean it up and clarify that subparts, the removal of subpart 2 and subpart 4. And then the notice provision is kind of bulked up, kind of like it was for 404B, to, again, clarify the notice that you have to give if you're going to use this type of evidence, do so in writing. So there's no more guesswork on whether or not did opposing counsel give me or not give me an appropriate notice. I mean, it's there in writing, so there's no debate over that. So it kind of streamlines things again, kind of like some of the changes with 404B. So with that being said, I will open it up for any questions on 807.
All right. Not All seeing right. any questions. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on proposals 5 and or 6? Not seeing any. Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Justice. Work.
The final proposed rule amendment is number 7, which relates to a proposed amendment to the speedy trial rule found in STCL 23A-44-5.1. Is there anyone that wishes to speak in opposition to that proposed amendment? Not hearing any opposition. Is there anyone that wishes to speak in support of the rule? Mr. Sazon.
Thank you, Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. The rule proposal really is intended to both respond to the current judicial declared emergency, but also provide a framework for how judicial emergencies will be declared in the future. So as you're very familiar, the 180-day rule sets the expectation that cases are brought to trial within 180 days. And then the way the rule is structured, Section 4 sets forth the exception to that rule. And so I'm aware of two instances that this court has declared a judicial emergency. One was when a tornado struck the town of Burke and damaged the courthouse, and the other on March 13th of 2020, the Supreme Court declared the judicial emergency related to the COVID-19 pandemic. And so as a result of that, the proposed Section G would really specify that the period of delay during a judicial emergency does not count against the 180 days. And this would be retroactive to the date the judicial emergency is declared. And so why does this matter? Currently, the court's order suspends the 180-day rule. So if a defendant, as we start to talk about unwinding from COVID-19, if a defendant is brought to trial now or at any time before the court would rescind its emergency order, the current order would essentially deal with that time period so that the circuit courts would not have to make a specific good cause finding to get around a delay or determine that one of the other exceptions is met, such as the defendant's consent. However, if this court, for instance, would decide on September 1st that the order should be rescinded, any case after that point, I think, will require the circuit courts to find good cause for any period of delay. Because of the way the order is worded, it suspends it during the existence of that order. This would make the 180-day rule and the statute and the exceptions capture the entire time frame, apply that time frame as an exclusion as a matter of law to the 180-day rule, which would alleviate the circuit courts from having to make those individualized findings in the future. I think that makes sense based on the framework and the way our judicial emergencies have been declared, which obviously are very rare. The statute 16.312 requires the Supreme Court to set a period of time in its order, so it will not be something that will be argued amongst the parties about when the emergency was declared or when it has expired. And so it really becomes a very straightforward, essentially math formula as to exclude these number of days during the judicial emergency. This was a creation and an idea that was struck at the last presiding judges meeting. As we started to have those conversations about what happens next with the judicial emergency order, where do we go from here, what are the things that we need to do to prepare for that and the number of cases that are backlogged or that are continuing to work their way through the system, and then, you know, what lessons have we learned how to respond to a large-scale judicial emergency declaration. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but that's the intent of the rule, and would ask for your support. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the members of the court? Not hearing any. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak on proposal